You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. 9 out of 10 elementary schools in Europe offer children the opportunity to learn multiple languages, but only a quarter of American elementary schools offer instruction in a language other than English. And enrollment in language classes at the secondary and college levels have been falling in recent years. But Americans may not be as language depauperate as we think, and that's in part because holding the bar at being fluent in multiple languages may not be the right bar. Merit Khan is the author of Four Words for Friend, Why Using More Than One Language Matters Now More Than Ever. Merrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed for having me here.
You have a very personal story of how you got started on this book. Where did that begin?
When I was born.
That's a very long project.
Yeah, yes. Well, I can honestly say that this has been on my mind pretty much my entire life. I was born in a home that where the dominant language, well, the family language, was a different one from the one all around. So at home, my father and mother spoke Polish to each other and to me. When I went out of doors into the outside world, well, English everywhere, which, of course, is an experience very familiar to many, many people, both in this country, in Britain, and also in the United States. Unfortunately, my experience was also very similar to that of many children in my position. When I did venture out into the big wide world, into school, I suddenly was hit by the full force of the power of the English language. And I moved away from being a very happily and balanced bilingual small child to being one whose language was taken over by English. And I ended up with an embarrassingly degraded and imperfect and wildly inaccurate form of my very first language.
Well, one of the main points you make in the book, though, is that you think we put too much emphasis on words like bilingual or multilingual and this idea that people should be fluent in more than one language, and say that instead there are significant benefits to just having some familiarity with languages other than the primary language that you speak.
Yes, I really believe that most people can do much more with more than one language than they realize. And one of the reasons that they undervalue their own linguistic abilities in this respect is this high bar, this ideal of bilingualism, the idea that you're only bilingual if you can speak two languages really well and equally well.
Right. You call that being a symmetrical bilingual.
Yeah, that's one of the terms for it. Symmetrical sounds lovely, doesn't it? Balanced bilingual. Well, actually, look, in this situation, it's very, very, very good to be unbalanced. It's much better than being completely monolingual. You can do so much with just a few words, actually, in many situations, even at one end of the spectrum, just those few words that you learn if you go to a country that you haven't been to before and you remember to learn how to say please and thank you and sorry. But of course, the significance of translating is you say, look, this is as far as I've got, but I have made a little bit of an effort to come some way towards you. I've come a little way towards your language community. And scaling that up into richer interactions, more sustained interactions, you can see that there really is a huge amount of value to just to very, very imperfect and limited interactions that nonetheless signal that you want to be closer to an individual or to a community or even to a nation.
Well, Merrick Khan, in Four Words for Friend, you write that not only are there these social benefits to attempting to, for example, speak another person's language when you are in their country or in their community, but that there are actually cognitive benefits to having a familiarity with multiple languages. What are some of those benefits?
Well, this is a complicated and controversial area. So there's two real lines of scientific thinking on this. Now, one is that the particular demands of having to work with more than one language, particularly when you're a small child, can help you understand what's going on around you and can help you relate to other people in more sophisticated ways. For example, there's rather nice research done among Italian-speaking children in which it turned out that the ones who had some facility in another language understood the rules of conversation better than those who had no such familiarity. So in other words, they had more of an idea of when an answer was appropriate, when an answer to a question was too long. And to demonstrate my own facility with that point, I'll stop there and move on to, I should move on to the big story, which is this idea of executive control. The idea here is that if you have more than one language in your brain, both of them are active, and the executive in your brain, that's the system that says, OK, pay attention to this, don't pay attention to that, and so on, has its work cut out for it, managing those two languages and keeping each in its proper place and stopping them from interfering with each other too much. And just like physical exercise, the idea is that cognitive exercise actually strengthens your cognitive functions, and possibly over a lifetime's practice can build up to a reserve that can actually help delay the onset of dementia. Now, this is contested science, but it's very, very suggestive and very, very important.
And is that the case if you are, you know, fully bilingual or multilingual and using multiple languages on a daily basis, as well as if you are someone who has just had a smattering of different languages, or like yourself, who has largely lost another language?
There's evidence either way, but I think it's probably safe to say that as with physical exercise, you know, like if you do a load when you're at college or whatever, but lie around on the couch for the rest of your life, you probably won't be feeling the benefits in middle age. There's a lot to be found out here, and there's some nice work that suggests that actually, you know, a short boost can do you some good, and also that learning languages in a relatively incomplete way can actually have some sorts of benefits later in life. So there's a lot to be found out here, and a lot of science to be wrangled with.
It sounds like, though, there's perhaps firmer evidence when we're talking about some of the social benefits of learning more than one language. As you were saying, there's the recognition of subtleties within communication, but you also point out that it only takes knowing a handful of words in different languages to start to realize, as the title of your book, Four Words for Friend, implies, that some languages have four words for what English may have one word for. We may have 10 words for what another language only has one word for. And simply knowing and recognizing that fact can have ramifications for the ways that we view not just communication, but societies and the world as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important gift for me of my awareness of more than one language is a constant awareness of language itself. One is more aware of one's thinking. And also, I think it helps you maintain an awareness that other people aren't thinking, shaping their thoughts in exactly the same way as you are if they're doing it in a different language. So the title of the book alludes to Russian, in which one is obliged to put one's friends into categories when one's talking about them. So I may say, when I'm talking to somebody about a friend of mine, I might say, so-and-so is a dear friend or a close friend or a very old friend. Well, that's quite a lot of information, and it's nice for me to do it. But I don't have to do that.
Right.
Whereas in Russian, I'm forced to choose between a number of different categories, and those boxes don't really map onto the way that English people describe their friends. And above all, there's the absence of obligation. And one effect of that is the implication would be that Russian speakers have more detailed maps of social networks, because, you know, you hear that so-and-so is a close friend of so-and-so's, but so-and-so is only an acquaintance of another, and so,
right,
and so on and so forth. So their maps are their social network maps are kind of more richly coloured than ours necessarily are in the English-speaking world.
Well, Marek Khan, as you write in Four Words for Friend, and as you're kind of alluding to there, you know, there are a lot of different ramifications of a language. It is not just a way to convey information. And in fact, you write that you view language as not only there to accomplish communication, but constructed to prevent communication. In what way?
Yeah, that's what language is about. If you look at the way that languages work in very, very different societies, you realise that there are as much about drawing a circle around peoples, as the great linguist von Humboldt once put it, as they are about enabling people to speak with each other and to share ideas. So although that seems like a paradox, it actually isn't. The process is that a group is defined and bounded by membership of a language community, by speaking one language. And the control of information, ideas, perhaps sometimes threatening ideas, as well as false ones or otherwise unwelcome ones, is controlled by the existence of that language frontier.
Well, Marek Kahn, you also, in Four Words for a Friend, look at the history of diversity of languages and write about how there are different parts of the world that are language diversity hotspots. The first one for me that springs to mind is the country of India, with something like, what is it, 200 plus languages, just an incredible hotspot for language diversity. And you say that there's actually a correlation between the diversity of languages spoken in some of these regions and the biological diversity, the ecosystems that are there. What's that all about?
Well, this has been argued for a large belt across the tropics, and it's to do with the balance between the physical environment, the climate of a place, the kind of plants that grow there, the kind of terrain, and the human elements of the environment. In other words, the people that are around you and may or may not be part of your community. So the super hot spot of languages and language diversity in the world is Papua New Guinea, where I think it's about 10% of the world's currently extant languages can be heard.
Wow!
And one striking thing about this is that languages, or varieties of languages, can be confined to really small groups, like a few hundred people. So it's kind of easy to imagine that in challenging terrain such as that of Papua New Guinea, which people from the West didn't actually realize was densely populated until they were able to fly over it in airplanes in the earlier part of the last century. It's easy to assume that this diversity is the product of physical isolation. So people are living in remote spots, they don't talk to each other so much, and so their languages diverge. Actually, the pattern appears to be the other way around. The people who live in the most challenging terrain tend to share languages more. The ones who differ are the ones who live in less challenging terrain, but live more closely to each other. And the suggestion is that if you live in the difficult terrain, then you need to cooperate more. You need to be able to speak with each other, other people, more readily. And also, I guess you probably need to enjoy the benefits that come from feeling part of the same community through sharing a language.
Marek Kahn is author of Four Words for Friend, Why Using More Than One Language Matters Now More Than Ever. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.